Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is David Thoreau, and I'm the president of the Independent Institute. I'm delighted to welcome you all to our event this evening. As many of you know, we regularly hold the series of lectures, debates, and seminars called the Independent Policy Forum here at our conference center in Oakland. Tonight, our program is entitled The Frankenfood Myth, Politics and Protests of the Biotech Revolution. And we're very pleased to be featuring the book of the same title called The Frankenfood Myth by one of our speakers, Henry Miller, who I'll introduce in a minute. It's a very unusual book. Anyone interested in genetically altered foods and the whole subject of biotechnology, I highly recommend it. For those of you who are new to the Institute, hopefully you got our registration packet. It includes information about our books. There's also a flyer on tonight's event, and you'll find on the flyer at the bottom of the front side information about our next event, which will be held on Tuesday, January 31st, and it's entitled Eminent Domain Abuse of Government Power. Those of you familiar with the recent Supreme Court Kelo decision will know that it's caused quite a bit of uproar for obvious reasons. That particular event will feature two speakers, one whose name is Stephen Greenhut, who's a senior editorial writer from the Orange County Register and author of the book Abuse of Power, How Government Misuses Eminent Domain. The other speaker is Timothy Sandifer, who's a staff attorney at the Pacific Legal Foundation in Sacramento. He's also a past Garvey Fellow for the Institute. More specifically, for those of you who are new to the Institute, the Independent Institute is a scholarly public policy research institute. We sponsor studies by leading scholars on major social and economic issues. The results are published as books. We also produce a quarterly journal called the Independent Review. This is the current issue, which is available also upstairs. And we do many other things. We have fellowship programs for students. We hold summer seminars. Those of you who do not receive our weekly email newsletter called The Lighthouse, you're welcome to do so by leaving us with your email address. We also notify people of upcoming events that way, and also when we have people on national television and other developments. One thing I also want to point out, one of our books is worth noting, which is this one called The Poverty of Reason. It's a critical look at the issue of sustainable development and the precautionary principle, which relates to our topic tonight. It's by an Oxford economist by the name of Wilfred Beckerman. And for those of you who are interested in that topic, that's something that you might want to consider. So for tonight's program, there's a lot of controversy, including in California, about this topic. And we thought it would be well worthwhile inviting two scientists who are well-versed in many of the key issues that pertain to it. For most of mankind's history, millennia, quite frankly, farmers all over the world have bred crops for their resistance to pests and disease, nutritional value. Within the last century or so, scientists have used an increasingly number of sophisticated methods for modifying crops at the genetic level. Of course, Mendel was one of the key scientists who developed the science of genetics. But only since the 1970s have advances in gene splicing and other aspects of biotechnology upped the ante, so to speak, with the promise of dramatically improved agricultural products, more resistant, more nutritional, and so on. But few topics have generated the kind of, not just local, but international controversy, furor, and perhaps misinformation. Public resistance in certain places is intense. It's fueled by fear. The question is, are the fears justified? And as I mentioned, part of the rationale for this is what's called the precautionary principle. Are the risks too high? Many people believe they are. The interesting thing about this is that many people not only believe the risks are too high, but many believe that it's too risky to even find out what the risks are. So to proceed with our program, I'm very delighted to introduce our first speaker, who's author of the book I mentioned. Henry Miller is Senior Research Fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford. He's co-author with Gregory Conkel of The Frankenfood Myth. Dr. Miller joined the Food and Drug Administration in 1979. He served a number of posts involved with the new biotechnology that was developing at that time. He is a medical reviewer for the first genetically engineered drugs evaluated by the FDA and was instrumental in the rapid licensing of human insulin and human growth hormone. He served in several posts, including special assistant to the FDA commissioner with responsibility for biotechnology issues. From 1989 to 1994, he was also the founding director of the FDA's Office of Biotechnology. So I'm very pleased to introduce Henry Miller.
Thank you very much, David. I'm delighted to be here to follow in the footsteps of Glitterati, who have spoken here before. But it's particularly gratifying tonight to share the podium with Bruce Ames, who has the distinction of being a world-class scientist who has made signal contributions to science in several fields, who's been an astute commenter on public policy issues related to science for as long as I can remember, and who is also a true gentleman. Let me begin by reading a brief excerpt from the very beginning of the Frankenfood myth, several paragraphs. Imagine a situation in which an impoverished developing country suffering severe food shortages in the midst of a year-long drought receives food aid shipments of grain from industrialized nations to help fill the void. Instead of saving the day, though, the food aid sits untouched in warehouses. Grain that could help prevent malnutrition in millions of people is locked away from starving villagers by government edict because it contains kernels of the same gene-spliced, genetically improved corn varieties consumed daily by scores of millions of Americans and others around the world, but that allegedly have not been, quote-unquote, proven to be safe. Eventually, starving citizens actually storm the warehouses to liberate the grain. If it weren't real, this scenario would be almost too implausible to believe, especially in the 21st century. Yet this was precisely the situation in the southern African countries Zambia and Zimbabwe during fall and winter of 2002-2003. So this is where the new biotechnology, variously known as recombinant DNA technology, gene splicing, or genetic modification, applied to agriculture finds itself after more than 20 years of stunning scientific and commercial achievements. We've had more than two decades of widespread pre-commercial and commercial cultivation of environment-friendly, enhanced productivity crops, including more than 100 million acres annually for most of the last decade. And yet the new biotech remains widely misrepresented and beleaguered by anti-technology and anti-globalization activists, poorly defended by its own practitioners, and discriminated against in public policy. So that sort of capsulizes the subject of the book and the topic of my remarks tonight. Before I go on, let me define some terminology for you, since sometimes it's confusing. Genetic modification is a very generic, general term that simply means any intentional alteration to the genomes of living organisms, and that can be accomplished in a number of ways, old and new. It can be done by applying selection pressure over repeated generations and selecting for certain desired characteristics. It can be accomplished by hybridizing two different but related organisms or through intentionally mutating an organism's DNA with radiation or toxic chemicals. It can also be accomplished, which is the basis of our being here tonight, by molecular techniques, highly precise techniques that splice new genes into an organism's genome. And these can be from another source. They can be genes that have been, in effect, synthesized, DNA made to order, if you will. Gene splicing or recombinant DNA technology is the prototype of molecular techniques for genetic modification, often to move single or at most a few genes from one place into another. And the purpose is to create discrete, precise genetic changes that are desired for some reason, for research purposes or for commercial purposes of many kinds. The classic paper which first described functional recombinant DNA, so-called because DNA was being combined, or in the scientific jargon, recombined from two different sources in a way that it was still functional, appeared in 1973. Since then, the seminal policy question surrounding this new technology and the products derived from it has been, should regulation focus on the characteristics of a given product or on the use of a certain process, gene splicing, of genetic modification? And this has raised some corollary questions. Is the use of gene splicing techniques per se risky? Does the use of these techniques affect product safety in a systematic way that warrants a special or sui generis oversight regime for all products made with them? In other words, with respect to safety issues, or for that matter almost anything else, are gene-spliced organisms and products meaningful categories? Another question is, what is the context of gene-spliced crops and foods compared to other similar products made with other techniques? Now, these are have been pivotal questions for a long time, and in a vacuum, if we had never carried out genetic improvement before, they could have been difficult questions to answer. But fortunately, science, common sense, and a long history of sophisticated agriculture offer answers to many of these questions. Now, David Thoreau, in his introduction, alluded to controversy over much of this subject. But I would say, and most other scientific commenters would say, that this is largely pseudo-controversy. You're all from the Bay Area, I assume, and so you know the old saying that the three most important aspects of real estate are location, location, and location. And the corresponding axiom for public policy is that the three most important aspects of it are context, context, and context. And let me give you some examples of what I mean by that, because once again, we are not operating in a vacuum. These are not products that were brought back from Jupiter by a space shot and that are fundamentally and basically different from what we've done and what we've seen and what we've grown and what we've eaten previously. Genetic modification, again considered generically, is so ubiquitous in agriculture and food production that the term is almost meaningless. Virtually all major crops grown in the United States have been modified by one technique or another. And so it's not nature that gave us products like seedless grapes and seedless watermelon, tangelos, well, the hybrid of a tangerine and grapefruit, or the pluot, a hybrid of plum and apricot, the latter having been concocted first by a farmer in San Jose, in fact. But it's plant breeding, often very laborious, very much trial and error, very slow, that has given us these products. And many of them have been extremely useful and sometimes even revolutionary, but using older, less precise crude techniques. Now, as I alluded to a moment ago, gene splicing is considered, certainly by the scientific community, to be an extension or refinement, an improvement over the kind of genetic modification that we've done for a very long time. Another important point of context is that the scientific consensus is extremely clear that the vast experience with gene-spliced organisms for food, fiber, and other products over more than 20 years shows a stunning record of environmental and food safety. A record, I hasten to add, that is hardly evident from the coverage in the media and from the bleeding of activists whenever there's a new advance or a new proposal. It's also evident that this scientific consensus has not diffused to as much of the public as we would like. If you look at the record of the anti-biotech referenda items in California, as many of you know, only last month, Sonoma County voted down a ban on gene-spliced crops, cultivation for research purposes, for experimental purposes, or for commercial use. But 45% of voters voted to impose the ban, which is far, far too many for comfort. And three California counties, Mendocino, Marin, and Trinity, wherever that might be, have indeed imposed bans on gene-spliced crops for any purpose. And we can talk later about the implications of that. Places like Marin are not big agricultural areas, of course, but except it is known for its fruits and nuts. But it as a symbolic act, it's important, it's antisocial, and it's undesirable. Another point of context is that very few new conventionally modified plants or other organisms, such as microorganisms for food production, undergo any kind of regulatory review before they're tested and marketed. And this is something that not many people know. And this is reflected in surveys that are taken by groups like Greenpeace and the Pew Initiative on Food and Biotechnology and so on. Because if you ask somebody whether a genetically engineered food, whether Frankenfood should be guaranteed safe by the FDA before people are permitted to eat it, of course they'll say yes. It's like asking people whether pederasts should be banned from teaching in the public schools. People don't understand the context of how food safety is currently assured. In spite of this context about food regulation, gene-spliced plants and the foods from them are subjected to a case-by-case review, often by multiple regulatory agencies, a regime that's excessive and illogical compared to other less precise technologies that are applied to agriculture and food production. Now, let me give you a couple of examples of what this discriminatory, asymmetrical regulation means in practice. About 40 years ago, in several parts of the world, there was a new variety of bred wheat produced called Triticum agropyrotriticum. Triticum means bred wheat, and agropyrotriticum is the new strain. And this was produced in the old USSR, the Canada, the US, France, Germany, China, and elsewhere. And T. agropyrotriticum consisted of the entire genome of bred wheat and hybridized into it through conventional techniques was the entire genome of a wild grass variously called couch grass or quack grass. And so this contains the ordinary expression products of bred wheat plus tens of thousands of new genes with their genetic expression products interacting, who knows how, with the macromolecules of wheat. when this new variety went into the field, no one, least of all activists or regulators, wanted to review it. No one asked whether the introduction of all of the genes from a wild grass make wheat more weed-like, more invasive in the field. No one asked whether any of these tens of thousands of new gene products introduce toxins or allergens. No one asked these questions when it went into the field first, when it was scaled up, when it went into commercial scale, or when it went into the food supply as bread. If someone, however, were to move a single gene from quack grass into triticum, into bread wheat, using gene splicing techniques, that would bring down a hugely expensive, dilatory regulatory regime that would involve at least USDA, possibly EPA, as well as FDA. The process would become vastly more expensive, much slower, and whatever you think of how much regulation is appropriate, it's impossible to reconcile the disparity between no regulation for a crude, an imprecise and unpredictable process, and massive regulation for one that accomplishes essentially the same thing, but is much more precise and predictable. It cannot be reconciled. Similarly, if you have high school teenagers who might want to enter a high school science fair and do a project on agriculture, if your student goes to a seed store and buys a packet of tomato seeds, takes them to a radiology suite and irradiates them, and then plants them to look for interesting mutants that would be caused by the radiation, there's no regulation by the government of any kind. But once again, if a single gene is moved into those tomatoes, or even a gene is deleted using gene splicing techniques, the student would have to obtain the services of an institutional biosafety committee, probably through a university or a hospital, and would have to somehow get permission from USDA and or EPA in order to plant those seeds. Again, this is the kind of discrepancy that can't be reconciled, makes no sense at all, and prevents the wider use, the diffusion of the superior technology from high school students on to multinational companies. Now, if you doubt that there's discrimination against the use of these newer, superior, more precise technologies, consider, as I said, the complete bans that exist in three California counties and one that was just instituted in Switzerland within the past week or two, they having a very liberal referendum policy similar to California's. I have a box of little packets of gene-spliced seeds, soybean seeds, that are available for you that have the book cover on the front. I hope you'll all pick up these up. But again, you can do whatever you like with these, as long as you don't put them in the ground in Mendocino, Trinity, or Marin counties. It's completely ridiculous. Now, let me remind you of some more of the distinguished history of genetic modification, considered generically, with which we all have a great deal of experience. The first slide is I think a quite interesting juxtaposition. At the top is the very primitive precursor of modern day corn, a plant that's still found in parts of Mexico called teosinte, and it's really quite remarkable that by dint of of very laborious selection and crossing that farmers and plant breeders were able to get from this to this. This is a primitive precursor of modern corn that's in effect been reconstructed by doing various crosses, just as an illustration to see what intermediates look like. But as you can see, the Teosinte has next to nothing in the way of kernels. But once we get here, we have closely packed, pretty regular kernels that are swollen with starch, protein, and oil. And then via conventional techniques, we've gotten to the modern varieties, plural, modern varieties of corn or maize that have been widely adapted and widely manipulated for a variety of purposes. So there are distinct varieties that are used for corn meal or corn oil, for feeding to livestock, or the wonderful sweet corn that we enjoy on the cob during the summer. And again, there are a huge number of varieties of this adapted to various microenvironments around the world, different climates and different sets of pests and disease.
Now, if I can see. It's essentially
the same story with a tomato. I'm only going to show these two, David, but thank you. Similar story with tomato. On the right, this little thing, cross-sectioned and stained, is the very primitive precursor of modern-day tomatoes that still does grow and is found in the Andes of South America. And more than an edible fruit or vegetable, this more closely resembles a golf ball. It's small, it's green, it's toxic, it's bitter, and yet over centuries, again, plant breeders and farmers have wrought amazing things through conventional plant breeding and gotten to the current day varieties of tomato. Again, different varieties intended for different purposes, very different varieties for processing into sauce or juice, eating and salads and for cooking and so on, and highly adapted for various ecosystems around the world. The tomatoes that you would grow in a backyard garden, for example, in Spokane, very different from those that you would want to try to grow in Savannah. Now, how have we been able to accomplish this kind of thing with conventional breeding? Well, Eric Lander, a professor at MIT, has a wonderful observation about that. Eric says, quote, evolution has been taking notes. It tries experiments. It wakes up each morning, does a little mutagenesis, changes a nucleotide here and there, and sees how it works. If it's a success, evolution keeps the notes. In this notebook, we have all the information of the greatest experimental tinkerer ever, unquote. And I would say, extending that rich metaphor through the centuries, plant breeders and farmers have edited that notebook. And so currently in the United States, there are some 200 crops, nearly all of which were introduced as alien species over 2 to 3 centuries. Since the U.S. was settled, and then over the years, these have been genetically improved to adapt them to local conditions, to climate, to local pests and diseases, and for various purposes. Gene splicing technology has similar goals, but is more precise, more predictable, and much faster. A current snapshot of where we are in gene splicing reveals improvements in traits that benefit farmers and processors, and I alluded to some of these already, and a few that benefit consumers directly. But there are not very many of these. One example, for example, is a long shelf life carnation that will last for a couple of weeks after it's been cut, much, much longer than conventional unmodified ones. There are currently about 200 million acres worldwide under cultivation to gene splice crops. That was actually 2004, about a 20% increase over the previous year. In the U.S., more than three-quarters of cotton farmers are planting gene-spliced cotton, and more than 90% of all soybeans are now grown from gene-spliced seeds. The advantages have been manifest, and perhaps we'll talk about this later, but not many of them are evident to consumers, which is part of the reason I think that there's been as much resistance as there has been. But some of the advantages include gene-spliced soybeans, resulting in a reduction in pesticide use of more than 20 million pounds annually, which produce about $1.2 billion extra for growers. And there are similar advantages of gene-spliced corn and gene-spliced cotton. There are a couple of little tidbits that you may find surprising about the state of gene-spliced crops and foods. More than 80% of processed foods on supermarket shelves currently contain ingredients from gene-spliced plants. Most of these are derived from corn, anything that's sweetened with high fructose corn syrup, for example. Anything that's made with corn oil, for example. And also, given that almost all the soybeans, and therefore soybean oil, comes from gene-spliced plants, anything that contains soybean oil, salad dressings, mayonnaise, and so on, all contain gene-spliced ingredients. As a result of this ubiquity on our supermarket shelves, Americans have consumed more than a trillion servings, more than a million billion servings of gene-spliced products. And from the dirt to the dinner plate, there's not been a single mishap that has resulted in injury to a person or an ecosystem. Not a single mishap with all of that experience, both in the field and in our food. I think the future of this, at least if it's not encumbered by regulation and activists unduly, holds a number of really astonishing things. Enhanced nutrition, production of medicines, so-called biofarming. The pun is in the spelling, B-I-O-P-H-A-R-M-I-N-G. Various environmental applications, such as the sequestration of heavy metals from contaminated waste sites. And one subtle one that could be very important to California and the western United States is water conservation. Scientists are working and have achieved some successes in introducing drought resistance and the ability to grow with lower quality water, such as recycled water or even brackish water. Water, as you know, is going to become an important issue in California and the West in coming years, particularly if we have another drought similar to the one that we endured about 15 years ago. Government regulation. Several points of scientific consensus I'd like to point out to you. First, neither the use of gene splicing technology nor moving genes per se makes organisms unsafe. Even moving genes across very great phylogenetic distances, that is between extremely unrelated organisms, is per se unsafe. What makes a difference is not the source of a gene that's being moved, but its function and the way it interacts in its new environment. Third, and this is just a common sense rule of regulation of any kind, the degree of regulatory scrutiny should be commensurate with risk. But as in those examples that I gave with Triticum agropyrotriticum and the our hypothetical student at a science fair, that rule is unequivocally violated in the discriminatory regulation that exists against gene splicing. In fact, what we've done is to create regulatory regimes in which there's an inverse relationship between the perceived degree of risk and the degree of regulatory scrutiny, something which is simply nonsensical. Official regulatory policy says much the same thing as my previous summary points, that merely the use of gene splicing techniques is not an appropriate trigger for oversight. But that has not been translated effectively into what happens on the ground at agencies like USDA and EPA and to a lesser degree FDA. At all of these agencies, the use of gene splicing techniques does provide the trigger for more draconian, more expensive, more involved regulatory regimes. And regulatory policies capture virtually all gene-spliced organisms, regardless of risk. The result is that experiments in the field are 10 to 20 times more expensive to do with a gene-spliced organism than with one that's been conventionally modified, but which is virtually indistinguishable. And if you do the math for that 10 to 20 times more expensive, you'll see that that 90 to 95% of your budget goes to unnecessary, gratuitous, unscientific regulatory requirements. This adds about $50 million to the cost of commercializing a new plant variety. $50 million is not terribly much in the context of developing a new drug, for example, but for developing a new insect-resistant variety of lettuce or a variety of cauliflower that's enhanced with a certain vitamin, it's really quite a lot of money and is debilitating. So, again, as a result of this discriminatory regulation, we have a regulatory morass which has spilled over to other areas, including questions of legal liability. Overregulation has already damaged whole sectors of agricultural biotech and mortally wounded others. In conclusion, then, as long as we continue to accept the myth that there is something uniquely hazardous and worrisome about gene-spliced organisms and their products, we'll continue to argue these issues, to have these pseudo-controversies ad nauseum and unnecessarily. The public will be hopelessly confused, as were, as I mentioned, some 45% of the voters in Sonoma County last month. Public policy will remain unscientific and contrary to the public interest, and practicing scientists who perform or wish to perform field trials of gene-spliced organisms will find much of their budget squandered by gratuitous regulation. Thank you very much. That concludes my remarks. And I'll turn you over to Bruce Ames.
Our second speaker, as you know, is Bruce Ames. Professor Ames is professor of biochemistry and molecular biology at the University of California at Berkeley. He's also senior scientist at the Children's Hospital Oakland Research Institute. Professor Ames has received the National Medal of Science from the National Science Foundation, the Tyler Prize, the highest award for environmental achievement, the Gold Medal Award of the American Institute of Chemists, and the Japan Prize, among others. He served on the National Cancer Institute Board of Directors, and he's a member of the National Academy of Sciences and the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences. Dr. Ames is the inventor of the Ames test, a system for easily and cheaply testing the mutagenicity of compounds. His research on cancer and aging, including more than 500 publications, have resulted in his being among the few hundred most cited scientists in all fields. Dr. Ames' research focuses on identifying mutagenic agents that damage human DNA and defenses against them. He's also working to elucidate the consequences of DNA damage for cancer and aging.
So my interest is in disease prevention. I worked for many years on causes of cancer, what's causing cancer, how do you prevent it, and then that always gets you into mechanisms. So I was interested in mutagens and how to prevent DNA getting mutated and all kinds of things. And in the course of it, I became more and more upset because the government seems to spend all its time on what I thought was trivia and not enough time on the important things. And as every businessman or anybody knows, if you have thousands of minuscule, unimportant risks out there, the public gets completely confused and they don't know what's important anymore. So I'd like to just discuss where I think. So I'm going to talk about risk more in general, what I think is important, and that's your diet. Everybody's eating lousy diets, and that's doing it in, not that part per billion of pesticide. So if you ask the top epidemiologists what's causing cancer, smoking is about a third of cancer, bad diets is about a third of cancer, I put too many calories, obesity, 30% of the kids come into Children's Hospital where I'm working now are obese, and obesity is linked to 40 different diseases. And too little fiber and micronutrients, I'm going to talk about that a bit. Then chronic infections, when you get an infection like hepatitis B virus in your liver, Helicobacter in your stomach, your white cells are trying to defend you against the invader. And what do? They pour out all these nasty mutagens, they're powerful oxidants, hypochlorite. You know what hypochlorite is? Clorox. So yeah, every time you get a cold or an infection, your white cells are defending you with Clorox, trying to kill that virus or bacteria. And that's a nasty mutagen. And then if they're also pouring out hydrogen peroxide and peroxynitrite, which nitrates you and oxidizes. So, and people are worried about chlorine. Every time you get a cold, you're chlorinating yourself from all this Clorox. So that's due, about 20% of the cancer in the world is due to chronic infections, all through Asia and Africa, hepatitis B, hepatitis C, and then, Helicobacter. Everybody in Japan's infected with this bacteria that lives, between the stomach lining. There's a sort of bag in your stomach protecting you against the hydrochloric acid, and the bacteria can get in there, Helicobacter, and cause a chronic inflammation. And so whenever you get that, it leads to cancer. And hormones, about 20% of cancer, estrogen levels are related to breast cancer, and testosterone levels to prostate cancer. So anyway, you get a lot of cell division. You can fix mutations. And occupations a little bit. People argue about this number, but this was my best guess. A few percent. And you want strict rules. You don't want every worker waiting around in chemicals, which happened last century. And we learned that occasionally the workers in the aniline dye industry, some of them got bladder cancer from aromatic amines and et cetera, et cetera. And chimney sweeps in England were going up and down the chimneys and they got cancer too. Anyway, so you need strict rules there. And then pollution is our big red herring, because we're spending all the money compared to anything else, everything else put together five times, on trying to get rid of that last part per billion of some pesticide residue or whatever. And it's not going to save any lives as far as I'm concerned. It may make people feel good, isn't it? So I think that's mostly a red herring. I'm not saying there isn't a farm worker getting doused in pesticide every day. It may well lead to some trouble. But the little bits of pesticide residue are not plausible as anything very serious in terms of health. Anyway, I'll talk about that a little later. Next slide. So we have this myth out there, there's a cancer epidemic. There isn't a cancer epidemic. Cancer rates have been coming down for years. The cancer epidemic there is due to smoking. And if you fact, so if you're correct for smoking, attributed to smoking, it's been going up. If you're correct for smoking, cancer rates have been coming down for a long time. So, the leading people correct for age, because cancer goes up with the fourth power of age. I'll show you a slide on that later. And so you don't want to look at cancer in a group of 80-year-olds, 70-year-olds, versus a group of 30-year-olds. There's not going to be much cancer in 30-year-olds. You get a little peak of childhood cancer where you've inherited a mutant gene from your mother or your father, but otherwise it just goes up inexorably with age. And so they look, so when they look at this, they look at cancer in a group, in the same age group in two different years. So anyway, cancer rates are coming down. This is by Sir Richard Peto, who's a leading epidemiologist in the world. Next slide. And a new study says yes, but 200 previous studies say no. Did you hear that, folks? The answer is yes. So epidemiology is a fiendishly difficult science. You have to be really smart to do epidemiology because it's so easy to get the wrong answer. And the you're looking at cancer, and the people are doing all sorts of different things. So the epidemiologist joke is Miami's a weird place. Everybody's born Hispanic and dies Jewish. So that's called confounding, which means that you think it's due to one thing and it's really due to something else. And anyway, epidemiology is good at detecting big risks, but it's useless for trying to detect some minor risk. And plus, one study says this, and the next study says that, and then finally somebody does a meta-analysis and puts them all together. It's easy to get the wrong answer, and reporters never put things in balance. It's always, there's a new scare, or there's a new something. Next. This says, my main fear used to be cats, now it's carcinogens. So why not do animal cancer tests? Rats and mice are relatively cheap, so people decided that after they saw that in the early chemical industry where workers were dipping their hands in the stuff and breathing it in and getting huge amounts that were really high exposure, a number of the workers got cancer, and we don't want our workers to be guinea pigs. So everybody said, let's test it in rats and mice. Now, it costs $1 million to do a cancer test in rats or mice because a third of the animals are getting cancer anyway. And you have the problem with statistics, so that you need at least 50 animals and 50 controls. And then people said, well, let's get the maximum mileage from the test. It costs $1 million to do an animal cancer test because pathologists are expensive and all of that. So anyway, we made a number of assumptions, and they've all turned out to be wrong. The first assumption was that what do we want to test? Well, we'll test synthetic chemicals. Those are the dangerous things. But 99.9% of the chemicals you're ingesting are natural chemicals. And everybody just assumed nature's benign. But every plant is full of 100 toxic chemicals it uses to kill off the insects and the predators. And so I'll talk about that in animal cancer tests. Exactly the same hit rate as synthetic meth. So one thing is we only looked at a very minor part of the chemicals we're being exposed to. And then, because of the occupational cause of cancer that we knew, and we just concluded, something shows up in an animal cancer test, that's what's causing cancer. And then to save money, we gave the animal the maximum tolerated dose. Well, the maximum tolerated dose is you find a level to kill the animal, you back off a little bit, and the animal has to lose 10% of the weight, otherwise you're not high enough. And you feed it every day of a lifetime. And, of course, when you get exposed, except for occasional occupational exposure, you're getting exposed to some tiny amount. So we made the assumption, well, if we can go from this huge dose down to a very low dose. Next assumption was carcinogen, and that's turning out not to be right. And then we made the next assumption is that carcinogens are rare. We're not going to find very many. We'll eliminate them, and we'll have a cancer-free world. And that isn't true either. Next slide. So Lois Gold, who's here, And I have written 150 papers kind of puncturing environmental balloons and traces of pesticide and all these kinds of things. And we put all the nails in the coffin, but the specter keeps on coming out because I won't go into all the sociology of that. But anyway, I think the science has been done with very well, and there really isn't anything there. So the first thing we pointed out is Lois runs the animal carcinogenic potency database. She's taken every animal cancer test in the world, put it in a database. It's all up on the web. You can see the potency of each carcinogen and who did the test and everything about it. Anyway, the first question is, carcinogens aren't rare. 60% of all the chemicals ever tested in rats and mice come out positive. Is this just because they're picking more suspicious chemicals? We don't think so. And then chemicals tested in rats or mice, it's 50% or more. So, and natural pesticides, you get exactly the same hit rate as synthetic pesticides. And every plant you eat is full of these things. And then mold toxins and natural chemicals in roasted coffee and commercial pesticides. Anyway, drugs that have passed all the that FDA database of drug submission, half of everything they've ever tested is positive, and we think it's a high-dose artifact. Sorry to... So the people who've been stuffing chemicals down the throats of rats for 20 years aren't very happy to hear this, and they really don't like us. But anyway, it's still true. Next slide. So Rachel Carson, for the first time in the history of the world, every human being is now subject to contact with dangerous chemicals from the moment of conception until death. Now, that's not a statement any toxicologist thinks makes any sense, because everything's chemicals. Rachel Carson's made of chemicals. And so if you want to say everything natural is...
She's toxic.
If you want to say everything natural is benign and everything man-made is evil, well, okay, but there's really no evidence. Aflatoxin's one of the most potent carcinogens they know, and it's made by a mold. And all the metals are carcinogens. Are toxic and carcinogenic, and those have been around through all of evolution. And our defense systems don't work chemical by chemical. Every time you eat a plant, you're getting 100 toxic chemicals. Broccoli has a different set than coffee, that's a different set than asparagus. And how do we deal with it? Our liver is just chock full of defense enzymes, and they work by group. You get an oxidizing agent into you, you induce antioxidant defenses, and then you're more resistant. So radiation is an oxidative. A little bit of radiation, the animal responds and puts up antioxidant defenses and more resistant to higher doses of radiation. That's how animals survive in a world of toxic chemicals, natural toxic chemicals. Anyway, next slide. So this is what's in cabbage. Sorry about all this, but cyanide, isothiocyanate, cyanide derivatives, all sorts of nasty things. And they're designed to kill. That's what they're there for. They're nature's pesticide, and they're designed to kill those insects munching on the plant or the predator eating the plant. And what plant breeders have done is to lower the level of these things, because when the potato came out of the Andes, it was chock full of solanine and chaconine. You feed a kid a meal of green potatoes, it can kill you. Because the green is just chlorophyll, but when the plant gets uncovered, it jacks up all its defenses because some insect can bite it, and it's just chock full of toxic chemicals. So anyway, that's how, and so if you test these things, and we did a search in Lois Gold's database, and we started finding a few natural pesticides been tested, exactly the same hit rate, half of them, as natural pesticides that have been tested. And the compounds they use as pesticides have already been screened through all of this. Next slide. So we did a calculation. You're eating 0.05 milligrams of potential carcinogens from natural pesticide, from synthetic pesticide residues, and natural pesticide residues, you're eating 1,500 milligrams a day. So 99.99% of the pesticides you eat are natural chemicals in plants. Well, and the hit rate is exactly the same in for breaking chromosomes or for finding carcinogens or mutagens or all that, yet 99.99% of the natural compounds. I'm not saying that's what's causing cancer. I think all these high doses are giving us the wrong answer, but it's you start looking at the whole picture, you don't get very worried about the parts per billion of pesticide residues. Next slide. So we did a table in one of our papers showing all the natural pesticides we could find that had ever been tested for carcinogen in the world. And these are all the carcinogens. These are the non-carcinogens, and the carcinogens are present in anise, apple, apricot, banana, basil, beer, broccoli, Brussels sprouts, all the way to tomato, turmeric, and turnip. So there's nothing you can eat in the supermarket that doesn't have carcinogens in it, a rodent carcinogen at high doses. Don't worry about it. Okay, next slide. And this is coffee. When you roast coffee, you get over 1,000 chemicals. So we went and looked up the whole coffee literature, and we found a list of 1,000 chemicals. We ran them through the database, and these have been shown to be carcinogens. These are not carcinogens. There's still 1,000 chemicals left to test. So it turns out you get more chemicals, more carcinogens in a cup of coffee than pesticide residues you get in a year. But the EPA drinks their cups of coffee and tries to get rid of that last part per trillion of pesticide residues. It's spinning your wheels and not getting anywhere. But that's what regulatory bureaucracies do. Yeah. Next slide. So this says, an activist, we have a scare story every week in the newspaper. Oh, this is just a quote. Falsehood flies and the truth comes limping after, so that when men come to be undeceived, it is too late. The jest is over and the tale has had its effect. Jonathan Swift. Next slide. Okay, this is some British toxicologists published this in a paper. It's an overview of aims and achievements of toxicology. The aim is to prevent human disease from chemical and or illusion, as you. And the reality is to provide living for contract laboratory, civil servants, lawyers, statisticians, consultants, and conference organizers. The achievements or the illusion is public reassured that chemicals are properly tested for carcinogenic activity, and the reality is public worried to death or indifference by politicians and sensational press testimony. Longer every year. This is women, this is men. Life expectancy in 1900, 46 years for men, 49 for women. And now, so we've gained 25 to 30 years over the course of the century. And I'll tell you in a minute, we're going to gain even more than that the next century. And they're really important things to worry about, not all this trivia. Now, as you may know, women have a longer life expectancy than men, and single men have an 8-year shorter life expectancy than married men. And both men and women know why. Single men self-destruct. They drink too much, and they smoke too much, and they don't eat any veggies. So it's the wives that civilize. Anyway, next slide. So now I'd like to talk about what's really doing you in. Okay. So you need energy made in your body every day, and you're burning fuel to do that. And burning means taking electrons from the fat and carbohydrate, and you add the electrons to oxygen, and you add 4 electrons to oxygen, you're home safe to water. But no machine is perfect. Even nature makes some errors. So you get 1 or 2% single electron addition, so you're bleeding off a little superoxide and hydrogen peroxide, and these are powerful oxidants. But we have defenses to deal with them. But in fact, they're not perfect. Nature doesn't want to be perfect. In the old, people didn't used to reach age 40. Age 40 was an old man or woman for most of human history. And so it doesn't pay nature to put a lot of defenses to get you to 70 because nobody got to 70 in the old days. So, next slide. Well, nobody in the sense of not lots of people. Yeah. Anyway, this is cumulative cancer risk. Rats, mice look like this. Humans look like that. So in 60 million years of evolution, we've gone from a short-life creature with a high-age-specific cancer rate to a long-life creature with a low-age-specific cancer rate. That's why they have to correct for age, because cancer goes up. And it's related to metabolic rate. Rats have much higher metabolic rates than people. I once was at a meeting of some epidemiologists, and Malcolm Pike was explaining that the Seventh-day Adventists have half the cancer rate and live a few years longer than everybody else, and they don't smoke, they don't drink, they're mostly vegetarians, they lead very moral, straight lives. And someone said, what do they die of? And he said, boredom. So anyway, the Seventh-day Adventists go out like this. Okay. So what that says to me is cancer is one of the degenerative diseases of old age. You're going to get people to stop smoking and eat good diets. This will come out like that. But it's built in with aging, and I'll tell you why. Next slide. So we got interested in DNA damage, and I got particularly – your DNA is getting battered up all the time. You get a lesion in the DNA, and then repair enzymes are always cruising along the DNA looking for trouble. And when they see a bulky group here, they just clip out a piece. It all gets filled in. And you repair the damage, copying the base pair. And then the damaged deoxynucleoside, what do you do with it? You pee it out. And then the very specific enzymes, the DNA glycosylases, and there are a dozen enzymes that are the same in bacteria and humans. They've gone up all the way through evolution, and that tells us what nature thinks is important. Half of them are for oxidized bases, so oxidation has always been important. And some are for alkylated bases and other things. And there you have very specific enzymes that look for that base pair, take the base off the sugar, and then another enzyme comes in, cleaves this, put in the right base, sews it up, and you've repaired it, and the base goes in the urine. So people in Berkeley get high on all sorts of things, but I was high on urine for a few years. And so we looked in human urine for the known radiation damage products, which are oxidative products, and we found them in rat urine and human urine. So we tried to calculate how many hits there were per cell per day. And, the answer is 100,000 oxidative damages get repaired out of every cell every day. So you're getting battered up all the time. And so when they put a benzpyrene in and find 1/10 of the 6 bases, is a benzpyrene or something, it's small potatoes compared to what you're doing to your own body just by living. And next slide. And it goes up with age. These are young rats. These are old rats. So by the time a rat is old, it has 67,000 or so oxidative lesions in per cell, in every cell of your body, all the time. And you're doing well because the rats mostly live a reasonably long life. Next slide. And so it's oxidative damage. So this is protein. You're oxidizing your protein. This is people. This is rats. This is people. These are two diseases of premature aging, progeria and Werner's syndrome. So you're oxidizing all the time, and as I'll show you, it gets worse with age. Next slide. And this shows lipids, so you're going rancid all the time. That's oxidized fat, and your brain is going rancid. And so it just goes up with age. Next slide. So we got interest in where all this oxidation is coming from. The logical place is the mitochondria, because that's where you're doing this burning. And the mitochondria, the most complex organelle in the cell, and it's your... burning the fat and carbohydrate and adding the electrons to oxygen. And so we wrote a review on it about 10 years ago and got interested enough in the review, we decided to work on it. So we're working on how to delay mitochondrial decay. Because more and more of the degenerative disease of aging, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, diabetes, are being tied to mitochondrial decay. Next slide. So there are lots of, this is the inside of a mitochondria. And you have these four complexes, which are called the electron transport chain, because you're passing the electrons along. And what you're doing is pumping protons across the inner membrane of the mitochondria, so it's like a rechargeable battery. You have a charge across this membrane, and that allows complex 5 here to make ATP. And you're making kilos of ATP in your body every day, and ATP powers your muscles, powers your brain, powers all your biochemistry. So you're running on ATP energy. And it's a compact form of chemical energy that you and it's all made in the mitochondria. So, and you're also bleeding a few oxygen radicals all the time. And as you get older, more and more come out. And you start going downhill. So, next slide. So this is young mitochondria, look nice and sharp. Old mitochondria, kind of fuzzy. Like old people. or some of us, anyway. Next slide. So mitochondria from old rats made those wrong with loaded cardiolipin, which is a key lipid in the mitochondrial membrane, lower membrane potential, lower oxygen utilization, increased oxygen leakage. And we've figured out how to reverse that, at least in rats. So I'm very optimistic that life expectancy is going to get longer, faster than this last century, because science, aging used to be considered way too complicated to work on, and now we have all the tools. I used to know the dozen people in the world who are any good who are working on aging. Now there are tens of thousands of bright young people getting into the field. So I didn't know it would do me any good, but aging people are going to live longer. Next slide. And so we've found a couple of normal mitochondrial metabolites we can feed to old rats. This just shows the cardiolipin going down. You feed this, it comes back. But I don't want to talk about that next. But just to say that all this exists, because I'll get back to it in a minute. Next slide.
What is
LCAR? Acetyl carnitine. University took out a patent on a work, and I founded a company called Juvenon that sells these pills. But I put all my stock in a foundation, so I have no financial interest in the company. But it's selling lots of pills. And this shows lipoic acid, which solves the problem of the extra oxidants and brings it down to the level of the young animal. So if you're an old rat, you can be very enthusiastic. If you're an old person, we still have to do more clinical trials. In a fit of enthusiasm, when we were doing all this, I called up my son in New York and said, one of my students seems to be changing old rats into young rats. And it was silent for a few seconds, and my son said, that's all very well and good, but you let me know when you do the next step, when you change old people to young rats. So your children don't let you get away with anything. Right. Next slide. So this is biochemistry. All people have worked out all these cycles and pathways and everything. Well, to keep that powered, what do you need? You need fuel. That's the fat and carbohydrate, a little protein. And you need your micronutrients. And the 40 micronutrients you need to keep all this biochemistry humming along. And I'm going to make the argument when you don't get enough of one, you get massive DNA damage. And that's what I think is doing a lot of us in. Anyway, that's the argument I'm going to give you. It's partly vision, but partly we're pinning it down.
So
but I wouldn't.
Are you sure you get enough of the 40?
Okay. Well, you could take a multivitamin mineral pill as insurance and try and eat a good, varied, balanced diet. Next slide. So, So we need about a dozen metals, iron, zinc, copper, manganese, magnesium, calcium, etc. And so people sort of forgot about deficiencies because you don't see much scurvy anymore. The British sailors used to go off on these long trips. 30% of them would die. Their teeth would fall out. They were all getting scurvy. But then they realized that there was something in limes that prevented it. So every British ship went out, picked up a load of limes, and the sailors all sucked limes. That's why they were called limeys. And they didn't get scurvy. And it was vitamin C. But 25% of the population is still ingesting less than half of the amount of vitamin C they need. Now, that doesn't mean that you load up with kilos of vitamin C every day and it's going to prolong your life. It just means that it's the people who are not getting enough are in trouble. And who are they? The poor and the obese. And a lot of people who don't eat good, balanced diet. So, and iron, a quarter of young menstruating women have less than half the RDA of iron. And iron deficiency really batters your biochemistry up. And I'll show you DNA damage, all sorts of things. Why? Because women are losing all that iron and they need to replace it. Most men are getting too much iron. So, and zinc, 10% of the population, et cetera, et cetera. So for whatever micronutrient you look at, we're talking about some 10% or more of the population is really low. Next slide. So, and the poor tend to be worse. This is iron, this is menstruating women, and this is black women. Next slide. And this, so I partly got into this because one, Jim McGregor, who's a cytogeneticist working at USDA, came to my lab, and he had just stumbled on the fact that when rats don't get enough folic acid, they break the chromosomes, just like radiation. He was irradiating rats, and he saw all these broken chromosomes, and then he gave them an odd diet where the folate was too low due to a mistake. And he saw just as many broken chromosomes as when he really zapped them with radiation. And he had just come to my lab all excited by this. And I put my graduate student to figure out why. And we figured out why. And next slide. This shows a human with a low folate who has very high chromosome breaks. And you feed him folic acid. It goes down. And then you put him on folic acid permanently. Next slide. And so we worked out the mechanism. It's just like radiation. Radiation, the dangerous part of radiation is when you get clusters of electrons and you damage a base on each strand. So these are wound around each other. And then the repair enzymes are always taking out the base, but then when it does that, this strand is holding it there. But if they're two across from each other, then this happens and you break your chromosomes. And those are hard to fix. And the radiation biologists think that's the most dangerous part of radiation, of these broken chromosomes. Well, folic acid deficiency does the exact same thing. Now, folic acid, does anybody know what the word folia means? It's a Latin word for leaf. My mentor at Caltech, when I got my PhD, first isolated folic acid from 4 tons of spinach. So you get it from greens. And a lot of people don't eat a lot of greens. And then they're not getting the folic acid and they're breaking the chromosome. Now they're adding it to the flour. Next slide. So this shows B12 deficient, folate deficient, breaking. Next slide. And some guy in Australia has also showed vitamin B12 deficiency and folic acid deficiency, break your chromosomes. Next slide. And this is B12 deficiency, quite common in elderly. Next slide. And so we got interested in iron because iron is the main deficiency in the world. 2 billion women in the world are anemic or borderline anemic, and kids. And in fact, Joyce McCann in my lab is writing a series of reviews on the brain growth spurt, the last trimester of pregnancy and the first 2 years of your life. You're making 10 of the 14th or something like that neural connections. You don't get enough iron, the brain doesn't do well. The kids don't do well in school. And we're talking about a lot of kids in the world and a lot of the poor. And you don't get enough omega-3 fatty acids, which are these long-chain fatty acids you get from deep sea fish. The brain doesn't develop well. And they've done rat experiments, human experiments. You don't get enough choline, the brain doesn't develop well. So we're trying to clean out that field and writing a series of definitive reviews. So I think the poor are doing in the brains, too, by not eating well. I don't know how much, but it's at least weird. These micronutrients don't cost anything. They're all dirt cheap. You can get at Costco, you can get a bottle of a year's supply of pills, 350 pills, for $10. So anyway, it's an insurance pill. It isn't going to, you still need to eat a good diet. But anyway, next one. So iron deficiency, your cells start pouring out oxidants, oxygen radicals. And we worked out, and this just shows, inadequate pregnancy outcome, anemic pregnant women. You get way more low birth weight babies, preterm babies, poor weight gains. All this has consequences. Next slide. And so one of the postdocs in my lab was looking at zinc deficiency, taking human cells in culture and making them slightly deficient in zinc. Again, they pour out oxidants, next slide, and they batter up the DNA. Next. This is something called a Common assay. So you're getting oxidative damage to DNA. And then another postdoc in my lab worked out why, and so we worked out the mechanism, and we found a half a dozen micronutrients end up disrupting complex 4 in the mitochondria, and when that happens, you start pouring oxygen radicals out into the cell. So it's like irradiating yourself by not eating enough iron or zinc or biotin or all these different things. And so now we've found about a dozen different vitamins and minerals that you take human cells in culture, make them a little deficient, and you start battering up the DNA, and the cells age prematurely. Next slide. So this is complex 4. When you knock that out, you start pouring out oxygen around, and we figured out why this deficiency knocks it out. Next slide. So the cells, this is biotin deficiency, they age prematurely. So they normally go through a certain number of population doublings before they senesce. So why is that? Because you're battering up the DNA and all that. And I think nature wants it that way, because through all of human evolution, the minerals have been required, and the vitamins have been required. And what happens when an animal ends up in an area where it doesn't have enough iron or enough magnesium? It has to prioritize. And what do you prioritize? Well, you want to scurry around and find some more food, and it couldn't care less about DNA damage and long-term health. So every time you're short of a micronutrient, I think from the time from the fertilized egg up until you die, you pay a price when you don't have enough of a particular vitamin or mineral. And half the country is magnesium deficient, and a quarter of women are iron deficient. And these things don't cost anything. It's crazy. So we shouldn't be spending our time on chasing after that little bit of pesticide. It's what we do to ourselves, and a lot of people don't want to hear that. Everybody's a victim, but it's what you're doing to yourself. Your bad diet and not getting exercise. Next slide. This is biotin filling up deficiency, human cells filling up with oxygen. Next slide. And we're filling in this table now. Next slide. Sorry, I got a little carried away. This is magnesium deficiency making cells senesce early, and you get DNA protein crosslinks. Next slide. Okay. Obesity. This was the cover of The Economist just 2 years ago today. And so you all know the country's getting obese. And obesity is linked to 40 different diseases. It's a disaster. Diabetes and the costs are going to go through the roof, because these aren't, you smoke, you die of a heart attack like that, or you get, in 6 months, you're dead of lung cancer. It's good for the country. You don't collect your Social Security. But these are diseases that are going to have enormous costs. So thin people are going to be paying through the nose for fat people for generations to come. And next slide. So obesity is going up, as you all know. A third of the kids coming into children's hospital are obese. Next slide. So what are the 10 leading sources of calories in the United States? There are no vitamins and minerals in here. Sugary soft drinks is the leading one. 10 teaspoons of sugar and no nutritive value. Cake, sweet rolls, donuts, pastry. This adds up. This is accumulative. Hamburger, cheese, pizza, potato chips, rice, rolls, buns, cheese bread, beer, french fries. But there's not much nutrient value in all of this. And so we're eating calorie-rich, micronutrient-poor diets. These people are all starving, even though they're fat, because they're not getting their vitamins and minerals. And poor people tend not to take vitamin pills. So I think there'd doing themselves in lots of ways. Now, part of this is all vision. We haven't proven it in people, but we're working on all of this yet and to find the exact level you need in people. But I think it's going to turn out to be true. Next.
You're going to live long enough to do it?
I'm 77 next week. So. Now, exercise. You need a little exercise too, you all know. And it's not just vitamin pills in food. It's not just vitamin pills that'll make you go. You need phenolics and plants, and you need fiber and all these things. But actually, they're all cheap. You could put them all in a bar, which we're doing right now. We're going to do a clinical trial on a bar with everything obese people are lacking. Obese people, when they assay for micronutrients, are at the bottom of the list. It's a surrogate for a bad diet. And next slide. So anyway, life expectancy getting longer, and I think it's going to continue to get longer if everybody doesn't get too fat, but anyway. There'll be the thin people who live long and the fat people who die. But next slide. This says, relax, I've come for your toaster. And the point of that is you don't want to scare people about thousands of minor hypothetical risks. You want to go after the important things, otherwise you never win the battle. And the public is completely confused now, and what you need to tell them is don't smoke and eat a good diet. Now, they know about the smoking, and maybe they vaguely know it, but they don't understand. That's what's really hurting their health. Let's see, is that it? Is that the last slide? Oh, I brought this just to show Henry. Jim Watson, who likes to throw hand grenades out all the time, on genetic engineering, a very safe technology. Let the greens walk into the sea. The only person who's been harmed by DNA has been Bill Clinton. Anyway. Watson has a sharp tongue and he pulls no punches. But anyway, okay, that's all. Thank you. Check, 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 check. Check.
Thank you very much, Bruce. We have some time for questions. Carl has the microphone, and we ask you just to make questions, no statements or comments. And hold the microphone vertical would be of help. So, any questions? There's one in the back there.
Just hollow the question up.
Do you see any, this is addressed to either of the panelists, do you see any difference or has there been any testing that shows any difference between taking vitamins and minerals through pills versus getting it naturally in food?
I think it's pretty much the same thing. There are a few rules. The folic acid you get in the pill isn't the right folic acid. It's an oxidized form, and I think they should probably use a reduced form, which is what it is in plants. But little things like that eventually get ironed out. And the vitamin E you're getting in your pill is one isomer. It's some synthetic things that shouldn't be in there, and you probably should be taking natural vitamin E. But those are little blips, and they'll eventually get ironed out. But mostly,
there are a few other little anomalies. Various kinds of calcium that you might get in a pill are somewhat less accessible than it might be in dairy products. And there are some forms of vitamin D that need to be converted in the body to an active form. If you get the precursor, you're unlikely to have an overdose of vitamin D because in the presence of excess, it won't be converted to the active form and those things. But it's pretty much as Bruce says. In general, you do just as well with synthetic forms.
I'll say one word about vitamin D. Vitamin D is the sunshine vitamin. You need a half hour of sunshine every day to make your vitamin D. And if you don't make it, you have a higher risk of cancer. And dark-skinned people in tropical climates are fine. Dark skin is developed in racially very different people, southern Indians, New Guinea, Africans, to protect you against all that burning ultraviolet light. But In Sweden, you need to have the whitest skin as possible because you need the vitamin D and they get so little sunshine. So it's that trade-off. So Swedes who go to Arizona or Irish who go off to Australia get melanomas. And Indians and Africans in the United States are all vitamin D deficient. There's a huge 80% of American blacks are vitamin D deficient. So if you have a dark skin, pop a vitamin D pill because it's been linked to all kinds of things. And the brain is just full of vitamin D receptors. Nobody knows what they're doing, but I suspect it's going to affect the brain, too.
How about the lady right there?
Horizontal. Okay. I have a question. Both of you have talked about high fructose corn syrup, and it seems like you have contrasting views about it. Have there been any studies done about high fructose corn syrup and folic acid and iron and what the effects of them? Dr. Thoreau seems to be pro high fructose corn syrup, and Dr. Ames seems to be contrary to it. Maybe I'm mistaken, but I'm just curious what any studies are done on that.
I'm agnostic about I'm agnostic about high fructose corn syrup. I just presented it as a fact of one of the more common products of corn, which is very highly represented by gene spliced corn. But it's as Bruce said, it's not nutrient rich. It's calorie rich. It provides energy, but very little in the way of advantageous cofactors.
There's some evidence that fructose may not be as good for you as glucose, but sucrose, which is what we put in our coffee, is half fructose and half glucose. But high fructose may not be as beneficial as sugar, but it's all due to the government anyway because of barriers to sugar, and people responded and learned to make high fructose from corn syrup to get around that. Anyway, it's complicated.
How about the gentleman right there?
Mr. Miller, Dr. Miller, are you aware of the mutant weeds in the state of Iowa that have been out of control and attributed to the use of Roundup, which has caused the increased use of other pesticides?
No, I'm not. But it's not surprising as it should have been evident from Bruce's very elegant talk, nature is very resilient. And when you put pressure, evolutionary pressure, on some organism, it's going to respond in a way that will increase its survival. And so if you have Roundup is a potent herbicide that's very, very widely used, as many of you know. When you put pressure on weeds or other plants that you're trying to kill, you're going to develop resistance in some proportion of them. And then you need to move on to other herbicides. So it's not at all surprising. But the important thing here from the point of view of regulation is that this isn't a safety issue of any kind. This is an efficacy issue. If you reap the benefits of Roundup or another herbicide, or for that matter, a pesticide for 5 years or 10 years before organisms develop resistance to it and decrease its utility, you've still had the benefit of all of the agronomic activity that has made possible. But there isn't a safety issue involved. So even if there are Roundup-resistant weeds in Iowa moving inexorably toward California, it's just not a big deal, nor is it unexpected.
How about the gentleman right there?
Requiring the use of additional pesticides, which you're suggesting might take 5 years to get a feel for?
I don't know how long it'll take. It depends partly whether it's used properly, how it's used, what the biochemistry is of the various weeds that can construct resistance to it. But it's similar to human antibiotics. You don't withhold the use of antibiotics from people who need them because their use is going to create resistance eventually. You use them, these products judiciously in order to prevent resistance, but when it occurs, you just have to move on to another substance.
Well, you mentioned antibiotics. Is the antibiotic marker gene that's in all the GMO foods in increasing people's resistance to antibiotics?
No, it's not. They're not clinically important ones.
Has that been tested?
Yes.
On humans?
FDA studied it when these products first came along 15 years ago.
How about the gentleman right here in the leather jacket?
This is a question probably for either Professor Ames or Dr. Miller. Deborah Coons Garcia, Jerry's widow, took her inheritance and rather than open up something like a tie-dye organic hemp farm, made a movie called The Future of Food, which is critical of GMOs and got rave reviews from the rocket scientists at places such as the San Francisco Chronicle. If either of you gentlemen have seen the movie, do you have any critiques of the point she raised in the movie is either wrong, irrelevant, or ignoring other significant countervailing facts?
I think she ought to stick to downloading songs onto her iPod. The movie is just silly. It ignores the facts entirely, and it ignores the. It just ignores the science completely. But it's another one of these kinds of things that feeds the pseudo-controversy that I discussed. Another one is within the past week or two, and Bruce and Giovanna Ames might know about this, there was the premiere of an opera. There was an anti-genetic engineering opera that premiered in Berkeley. No surprise, but again, the pseudo controversy continues to grind on, in spite of the kinds of phenomena that I described, in spite of the discriminatory, irreconcilable regulatory policies that I described, the companies such as Monsanto have not been particularly helpful in dispelling some of these myths and in educating the public. They've actually, to a surprising degree, embraced discriminatory excess regulation and have made some really injudicious choices in the products that they've developed. A good example is the very first veterinary product made with recombinant DNA techniques was bovine growth hormone administered to dairy cows to increase their output. Well, you know, for the very first veterinary product, it might have been a good idea not to tamper with nature's most nearly perfect food, you know, with all the symbolism of mother's milk and all that. They could just as easily have developed porcine growth hormone to give us leaner pork that they were working on anyway. So that's a different subject, but it illustrates part of the problem that we have all of this pseudo-controversy raging and some of the uninformed resistance to biotech that we do have.
The lady right here.
How do you feel about using sugar substitute to save a few calories?
Well, I'm in favor of it. I'm more familiar with some of the studies of the popular fat substitute, Olestra. I'm a great believer personally and an avid consumer of Olestra chips, which have no absorbable fat. And I defy you to tell
less nutritive value.
less nutritive value. That's true. But if I have one of Bruce's pills along with a bag of chips, I'm probably doing okay. But again, you can. You can consume more chips for the same number of calories And it's very difficult now to tell the difference between Olestra chips and real chips. But the studies show that that in general, people consume the same number of calories. They're getting less saturated fat if they eat Olestra chips, but they do. If they're unaware of what they're eating, they'll just eat more of them and consume the same number of calories. So it's not great for a weight loss diet, but it is pretty good for eating less saturated fat if that's your goal.
Henry, you'll just have to eat carrots.
What's that?
Question for Professor Ames. Several years ago when you formed Juvenon to distribute what you call Alcar or alpha-L-carnitine, there was very good suggestive evidence that using it in rats made them run mazes better and maybe increased the lifespan. And now it's been several years since then.
Lifespan, it did not.
It did not.
But we only tried one dose. We're going to try it again in mice.
Well, that's what I'm getting at. Has there been any further results that show more or less benefit with Alcar in the animals, and are there any data in humans whatsoever?
Oh, yeah. In humans, the company just had a successful clinical trial on hypertension. It lowers blood pressure. And in rats, it seems to lower triglycerides, so we're going to do a test on that. Anyway, the company had 5,000 unsolicited emails from customers all raving about it, and 25 saying they got a side effect, almost all rashes. The side effects are very minor. And so a lot of people say they just feel a lot better. I didn't feel any difference myself, but I'm pretty bad.
About the gentleman right here.
Could you perhaps pick out?
No, you're right.
I don't need it.
We need it.
Could you pick out one of your major ideas that you think are important and comment on how you think it's penetrating the United States and the marketplace of ideas, or how you feel, or if you're disappointed or happy or excited, or how that's going? That's a big question, I know.
Well, I'm a chronic pessimist. I'm never happy about public policy. Virtually every time I bet on regulatory agencies to do the wrong thing, I win. FDA, where I spent 15 years, is having terrible problems and doing worse all the time and becoming more risk-averse all the time. EPA, which Bruce has mentioned a number of times, I think, and I may understate when I say this, may be the worst regulatory agency in the history of the world. Just relentless corruption, stupidity, anti-science, anti-science ideology inside. EPA really sees science as something to be manipulated for their own bureaucratic advantages. But I think the many palpable benefits of ag and food biotech are beginning to take hold, and we're seeing great successes in places like India and China, not only benefits to farmers, but public health benefits and use of less agricultural chemicals and more favorable agricultural practices such as no-till farming, which decreases soil erosion. So I think we're seeing some medium-term and long-term advantages becoming visible there. On the other hand, more than 99% of the huge amount of cultivation that I described, and we just passed the billionth acre milestone of cultivation of gene-spliced plants, more than 99% of that is for large-scale commodity crops, corn, cotton, canola, and soy. And until we start to see it for other things, lettuce, broccoli, carrots, whatever they are, and especially moving into subsistence crops, sorghum, millet, and so on, where a little bit of enhanced nutritional value can go a very, very long way for people who are on subsistence diets, I don't think we're going to see anything near the potential realized for ag biotech.
But, well, I'm an optimist, and Henry's a pessimist. And it's awful, but the world's moving along. It's always two steps forward, one step back. I mean, when you look, I mean, every intellectual in the world believed in something crazy. They were all socialists at one point, and that led to a mess. And then, you know, that's how life is. People are nutty.
My question concerns perspective that perhaps various sections of the public have towards science. For instance, there seems to be something called cultural wars that are surfacing or resurfacing now in terms of, let's say, evolution versus intelligent design or some facet thereof. Do you think this and the politics that derive from this are impacting the regulatory agencies that you speak of that in many ways hamper science such as gene splicing or things of that sort now that really maybe compared to other Western countries, the United States has a internal problem maybe more so than might exist in some of the other Western countries concerning biological sciences?
I think we're better off than Europe. Europe is drowning in regulation, and so, you know, you don't expect regulatory agencies to work. The monopolies and their incentives are perverse, so the main incentive is to metastasize, and they do that very well.
You have to get used to the fact that the agencies exist and are supported by interest groups that use them for their own purposes.
Big industry likes regulatory agencies, then they don't get competed, then small companies can't compete.
Right. That's the source of the problem.
It's been a well-known, well-documented, there's been revolving door of executives from Monsanto working at the USDA. So how come there's a problem with a morass of regulations when they are running
Monsanto
the USDA.
Likes regulation because then the little guys don't compete with it. All the big companies can spend to get a drug through FDA is what, close to $1 billion? And the big companies like that because they have the teams of lawyers and the little companies can't compete.
Bruce is right. In the Reagan administration, when I was in the government, Monsanto came in and asked for excessive process-based regulation, partly to prevent seed companies and startup biotech companies from being able to compete with them, and partly perhaps because they thought it would assuage the objections of some of the activists, which, of course, didn't happen. The big companies have been a problem all along, and as a result, we now have about five major ag biotech companies compared to several dozen 20 years ago.
The model to keep in mind is many drug and food companies view the FDA as a public utility regulatory body that they then have to utilize to socialize their risk and liability and to exclude competition. That's that kind of mindset is the problem, I think. And people believing that it somehow is actually improving the situation. One more question. How about the lady right here?
Dr. Ames, there was a wonderful article in Alternative Medicine about, I think, 6 months ago on your theory of the devastation wrought by the lack of one essential macronutrient, and you again said 40. What are the 40? Where can we learn what the 40 are?
I once made a list, and I lost it, but I'll make it. They're the essential amino acids, essential vitamins, all the minerals that you require, omega-3 fatty acids, oxygen. I don't know. They're all these ingredients, may oxygen isn't really a micronutrient. Yeah, I have a website, but I don't have that up on it. I'll put it in a paper sometime. What is my website?
Bruce, you can put it in that.
BruceAmes.org, I think.
Bruce, you can put it in that book we've been talking about.
Yeah. Let's see. I have a sheet. I hope that might be I never look at my website. Yeah. Yeah, I think that might have it. I have a handout if anybody wants it. And it might have my website.
So
is my email.
This discussion obviously can and will continue. I want to thank Dr. Ames and Dr. Miller for their wonderful work and their presentations. And the book, The Franken Food Myth, is upstairs. For those of you who don't have copies, I highly recommend it. Henry will be delighted to autograph copies for anyone who would like. And thank you for joining with us. We look forward to your being here the next time. Good night.